This is WJBC This Week.
Obviously, that's not the kind of politics that we want here in Bloomington, and we need to be more than that. I need to be more than that.
The mayor should be ashamed of himself for using his son to try to create some kind of controversy or cover what he did.
If the driver was Latino and the victim was white, then we would get the full force of the investigator.
For me to charge someone just because they were minorities, that would be racist.
I hope some people can hear about my story and get motivation from it.
I've never seen a kid work, you know, get through something like he did. I mean, his perseverance is amazing.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we recap the top news stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, Bloomington's mayor goes on an online rant against a conservative blogger. We'll hear from both sides. The architect of Uptown Normal explains Uptown 2.0. An Illinois Wesleyan professor studied the Tea Party and was a bit surprised by what she learned. A Democratic state lawmaker says the state's legislative mapping process is unfair. And a local high school student overcomes a potentially deadly illness and is honored for his inspiration to others. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner got himself into an online dust-up with conservative blogger Diane Benjamin this week. Benjamin, a frequent critic of the mayor, referenced the mayor's 18-year-old son in an online post and suggested a relationship between he and two Illinois Wesleyan students who spoke critically of Alderwoman Judy Stearns. The mayor suggests it's part of a conspiracy. He talked with the WJBC's Scott Lachlan this week.
What prompted this post from you?
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely should never have responded. And I, you know, there's no question about that. If it hadn't involved my son, I certainly wouldn't have. Frankly, I'm prepared to be attacked and verbally savaged every day as mayor. You have to be. It goes with the territory. What I was totally unprepared for, though, Scott, was to have someone take aim at my son, and especially someone who constantly savages people on her so-called blog. So, frankly, I kicked into protective father mode, not mayoral diplomatic mode. And of course, it's a bad situation to just communicate everything that you have in the heat of the moment. It's really
bad. Let me interrupt you and ask you, what did she say specifically about your son?
She implied that she supposedly had evidence to prove my son was involved in the conspiracy. She said that she even had more than just the beginning. She said she'd investigated his Facebook page. And so I get this text. I was actually in bed. I wasn't quite asleep, but I got this. I was in bed at 11 o'clock at night, and I heard a text. It was from my son. I went and got it, called him, and then stupidly, I immediately went on the blog and responded. This has all happened in about 8 minutes. And, you know, this is not appropriate. Right? I mean, I know this was prompted because somebody came after my son, but I did allow myself to get into the gutter with a very small group of people who just have to be, you know, kind of go down this path. But from my perspective, my son was absolutely not fair game. I mean, they can trash me all day long, but when they went after my son, I just kicked in, and that wasn't appropriate.
Let me jump in here.
I'm sorry.
I read all this. I read the blog piece. I read the comments, and through the comments is where your son came up, and basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, in a nutshell, we're going to talk to Diane in a few minutes, that a couple of people stepped up to the podium at the last city council meeting. She is accusing them of being in your camp, and then goes
and
on further through Facebook.
My son,
And that these people that spoke at the last Bloomington City Council meeting in your camp, through a Twitter or Facebook post, one of the guys that stepped up to the podium was having lunch with your son. And basically she's saying, yeah, these guys are friends of Terry Renner. Here's proof. He's having lunch with Terry's son right now.
And that's all I got out of that. She has more, you know, that's only the beginning. She had more. She's checked out his Facebook page. At the end of the day, right, this is the kind of nasty kind of guttural politics that we see in Washington. We see it in Chicago. We see it in New York. But we don't – it shouldn't be happening here in Bloomington. And I did allow myself to be drug into the gutter on this. It is absolutely something I deeply regret. There's no question about it. You know, actually, I was reminded, a friend of mine I talked to last night reminded me, this is Bloomington, and it's not like New York. We had former Governor Nelson Rockefeller back in the 76 campaign as a sitting vice president, gave the finger to somebody in the audience, you know, who heckled him and something. And obviously that's not the kind of politics that we want here in Bloomington. And we need to be more than that. I need to be more than that, irrespective of the fact that we have a small group that insists on being how they are.
So you've apologized. Have you apologized to her personally?
No, I apologized to the city, to my council, to the city, employees. I would not apologize to somebody who tried to come after my son.
That was Scott Laughlin with Mayor Terry Renner, who on Friday said he called Benjamin directly to apologize. Benjamin also talked to Scott this week.
What conspiracy is he talking about?
I think it's an excuse. The whole thing started with a post I did called, "Does Terry Know That Judy Isn't Running?" Because for two council meetings in a row, these IWU students have showed up at the council meetings and attacked Judy. It's like, okay, why attack Judy? And then it dawned on me, the budget's coming up. And gee, what happened last year at the budget? Judy came up with cuts, Terry attacked her, the tax increases went through. Terry wanted to do a preemptive strike on Judy to silence her. And then somebody made a comment, and I commented back that his son just happens to be Facebook friends with the guy who came, and Terry evidently thinks that's an attack on his son. I have no idea how that's an attack on his son.
Do you want me to read this, or would you like to read his comment that caused all this controversy? Do we have some romantic music we can play behind this? It is Valentine's Day. It's right around the corner.
Oh,
I'm going to read it again because I read it about an hour ago, I think. I want to read it again, okay?
Okay.
All right. No, Diane, it shows what an absolute and total piece of garbage you are. Actually, worse, because garbage can be converted into something useful. You are a total absolute human cancer. Please quote me on that. I haven't checked this site in ages because it's mostly crazy BS, but he didn't say BS, if you get my drift there. Mm-hmm. It's mostly crazy BS to be charitable. But when you attack my son, you're going to pay the price, you sick, dirty, slimy, ignorant fool. And frankly, that's raising you to a level you absolutely don't deserve. Nothing you ever report on this site makes any sense because I will give people anything they want to know about their government. Diane, you really are the craziest human being I've ever known. This will be my last post on this sick site of the worst part of humanity. The fact that some of you still think you're Christians is pathetic. There is a special place in hell for you. Okay, this is, if I were to write that, it'd be one thing. But this is the mayor, and that's why this is news this morning. I think we had people call and saying, why are you giving this any attention at all? This isn't news. Well, I think it is news because it is the mayor posting something like that on a blogger's website. But this feud, this start, I would call it a feud. Would you call it a feud?
I just post facts. You know, and he doesn't like it that he can't control the message. He doesn't like what I post. So he's trying to shut down political speech to get his own agenda through and his own tax increases and his own higher spending. And that's why he attacked me.
I asked him if you'd ever appear, because he has an open door policy. His office is open the Friday before a Bloomington City Council meeting. Have you ever gone there to just sit down and talk with him one-on-one?
No, but because we had a falling out, 6 months after he was elected. We used to correspond quite a bit by email. And I finally got tired of the lies that he kept emailing me and said, okay, that's enough. I've had it. I just post facts on my site. I post video from the council meetings, links to documents that are on the city website, investigations of things like the Coliseum, and Terry just can't stand it.
That was Scott Laughlin with the blogger Diane Benjamin. Uptown 2.0, the brainchild of architect Doug Farr with the Farr & Associates, has presented several options to renovate Uptown Normal. One concept involves where a mandated pedestrian crossing will be built at Uptown Station. Normal was initially planning a crossing over the railroad tracks. Now the town is looking to go underground, a move that would cost more and take longer to build. Farr talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney about that and the Uptown's renovation this week.
If one of them was already okayed, why was there a need to have an under-the-track look?
Sure. This has a longer history maybe than your listeners appreciate, but over the years, different proposals had been made for underpasses and overpasses by a series of consultants. When we came on board, we pulled out all of the prior studies, you know, got them on the same page to literally see what they are year by year and to normalize the costs. And so, frankly, looking back, some of the cost estimating wasn't as tight as it might have been. So decisions may have been made. We weren't sure based on numbers that were or were not accurate. So that was one of the first things we did was let's figure out the catalog of all the prior ideas. Let's put them on a page and get accurate prices for those. So we did that. And so the idea is an old one. And, you know, I think the thing to say is the way I think about this is the Amtrak bridge that is still the current plan, even though it's, you know, paused and council has directed staff to research other avenues, it's still the current plan, was useful for really one thing, and that was getting Amtrak passengers up and over the tracks to the other side of the tracks, which was an insistence on the part of the railroad, not even Amtrak. Arguably, you know, if you consider a lot of people with a lot of luggage, it doesn't do such a good job at all that. So our assignment is a different one, which is, goodness, there's a lot of potential demand in Uptown Normal for housing, for offices, for retail. We are running out of room. And where are you going to go next? And so we've looked really strongly at the municipally owned land south of the tracks and how best to connect to it. So if you want to have a more effective long-term development that creates, you know, wealth and value over the long term, an underpass seems to be judged universally to be preferred. And so it's not my opinion. We put this to all the groups that met when the community came together last week, and five out of five of the small group discussions came to the same conclusion.
Okay. Let's talk about the development as you see it south of the tracks, because that seems, as you say, that seems to be the only logical place to go next.
Yeah, it's the largest, you know, municipally controlled site, and I think there's a lot of potential to expand what we all think of as Greater Uptown. You know, how far south does it go? How far east, and so on? Obviously, it's bounded on the west pretty tightly by ISU. One of the things that we've heard from a lot of people is there isn't a lot of open space in Uptown. There isn't a park. There isn't a lawn where we could have movies in the park. Those kinds of things. So we think that one of the key destinations south could be a park. Number two, we had met with the library board. They are actively looking for an opportunity to upgrade their facility on a different site. They looked on the east side of town and some uptown sites. We embraced their feasibility study and did what we would call a test fit for fitting their new library south of the tracks, and that could be a really attractive anchor. And I think, again, the community spoke and really liked that idea that you could slide under an underpass, arrive at a nice park, and have the library facing that park. And then the remainder of the land, and this is a long-term plan, obviously, but the remainder of the land could be used for housing and office and some retail, essentially another kind of another mini uptown.
And do you continue to marry the look of uptown as it is developing right now with south of the tracks development? Will it all kind of flow together nicely?
Well, I think just the professional advice, we haven't gotten to that level of detail, but the professional advice I would give is you want the public spaces to flow. You want it to be the most natural thing in the world that people would continue their walk, you know, to the south there. And that's a kind of normal specific thing. If those of you, your listeners, who are familiar with the ISU campus and know how that kind of walkway tucks under Main Street at the other end of the campus, that's the norm in town. So, again, we're not inventing it. It didn't come from another state or another city. This is all local stuff.
That was Doug Farr from Farr & Associates with our Dan Swaney. Illinois Republicans have long complained that the legislative mapping process in Illinois is unfair to them. The process has been controlled by Democrats who have used their legislative majority to draw district maps every 10 years that have favored their party.
Now, a Democratic lawmaker wants the mapping to be taken out of politicians' hands. Chicago area representative Jack Franks talked to WJBC's Terry James this week.
What I'm trying to do is change the decades-old practice where incumbent legislators gerrymander districts to make sure that they get reelected. And instead of having legislators pick their constituents, I'd actually like the voters to choose their legislators. And this is something I'd like to work with the governor on, and I want to change the process so we have a nonpartisan process where it's done by computers and those that don't have any skin in the game to do what's best for the people and keeping communities intact and not looking at where a legislator may live to determine what the boundaries of that district should be, but making the districts as compact and as contiguous as possible while keeping communities together.
Can you explain to me, and I'll give you two situations here. In Bloomington Normal, we have both the 18th and 13th congressional district here. Why don't we just have one? Also, I used to live in the 17th congressional district. That stretched from north of the Quad Cities and included one street in Springfield. How does that get passed?
Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to end, Terry. It looks, if you look at the map, it looks like a Rorschach test. You know, it's crazy. And the only reason those were drawn was to give incumbents a leg up. So they had one street in Springfield that was obviously to connect another area in another part of the state so that person could be protected. I want to end all that nonsense. And we should have the districts much smaller, and I'd like to keep entire towns together. So Bloomington isn't broken up into two or three districts. We should have one representative for all of Bloomington. We should keep people together. And the way we have the law now, that it doesn't care at all about the voters. It only cares about the incumbents. And I care much more about the voters than our 17 congressional representatives.
Now, this kind of goes to the complaint that Congress has a low approval rating, yet we see the congressmen for each district get reelected over and over again because they have people in their district who like them, but they just don't like the rest of Congress. Do you think the way that the districts are drawn have something to do with that?
Absolutely. And we need to have more competitive districts. The way the districts are drawn now is to keep one party in power who has that district. So you have overwhelmingly Democratic districts, perhaps, in the Chicago area and overwhelmingly Republican districts in downstate. What we should do is not worry about what the composition is of the voters, but just break these up in proportional areas so we keep the communities together, which I think would make the districts much more competitive. So instead of it being, you know, a 60% Democratic district or something, perhaps it's closer to 50-50, so we'll have real people running that have a real chance of winning and making it more competitive.
And we're talking with State Representative Jack Franks from Marengo. You know, the 20 years I've been covering news, I hate to be a Debbie Downer, but this issue has been brought up every single time redistricting comes up, and nothing ever changes. Why would we believe that it would change now?
Well, I think with a new governor who's helped pushing it, I think we have a better chance. As you may recall, last year, then-candidate Rauner was trying to put something on the ballot like this to have a constitutional change on how we redistrict. My research indicates that we don't necessarily need a constitutional amendment, but we can actually do this statutorily because that's how we set this up in the General Assembly. So I'm trying to change the law through the General Assembly and not through the Constitution. So I think we have a better shot at it this year.
So by having state representatives, people at the State House make this decision, we could keep our congressional folks out of the mix then on this?
Well, as it is right now, the state folks are the ones who draw the maps for both the state folks and the congressional people. What we would do is take all of us out of this and get a nonpartisan process done by the State Board of Elections. I don't think that politicians ought to be involved in picking how their districts look. I want to take all of the elected officials out of this.
Well, and it does seem that there has been a complaint. For instance, as I mentioned with you, the 17th, which is one of the most oddly drawn districts, the concerns of people 2 hours north do not necessarily match the people of 2 hours south.
Correct. Correct. And the reason why we have these discrepancies is because these districts were drawn specifically to help one particular member of Congress or one particular member of the General Assembly. We, people like me who are elected officials shouldn't matter more than the people who vote for us. So it shouldn't matter where we live or what's best for our political future. What we should do is look what's best for the communities in which we serve.
Now, you actually connect this to voter turnout, saying that citizens feel that their votes don't count in the way things are currently done.
Yeah, I really believe that. You see, the voter turnout just keeps falling in this state, and a lot of it has to do with people being upset with their elected officials and also the corruption that we have in Illinois. But also, when the districts are drawn in such a way that it's so overwhelmingly strong for one party one way or the other, some people just say, why bother? Because no matter how, it doesn't really matter, because we already know who's going to win, because that's how they drew the district. And I want to end that. I want to have real competitive districts so that our representatives have to be more responsive to the taxpayers.
That was State Representative Jack Franks with our Terry James. Franks admits he's found little support from fellow lawmakers. A group hoping to get such a measure on the statewide ballot last year failed to get enough ballot signatures. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. An Illinois Wesleyan sociology professor says the Tea Party is a far more complex organization than is often portrayed in the media. Megan Burke says her perceptions of the group changed after talking to many of its members in Illinois, and she wrote a book about it. She talked with the WJBC's Scott Lachlan this week.
Let me ask you what your idea of the Tea Party was before you started looking into the Tea Party.
Well, of course, when the Tea Party became popular, I was paying attention to the news like everyone else. But, I'm someone who studies the way that people talk and think about race, and especially how that thinking impacts the ways that they want to change their world. My first book was about a very different population, stably racially diverse liberal communities up in Chicago. And so when the Tea Party came about, I thought, this is really a group that I can't ignore because of that very thing that I study. So it was really kind of about that racial discourse that they were getting a lot of heat for, and I think still do in some ways. And I thought, well, this is what I do, so I'm going to dive in and see what's going on here.
All right, so once you started looking into it, was there anything that surprised you?
Definitely. I think given a lot of the criticism that the Tea Party has gotten for the way that they talk about race and some signs that were at some protests and things like that, I think there was an expectation that there would be something particularly strong or particularly unique about perhaps their racism or the way that they talk about race. What I found instead was that the way that they talk and think about race was not at all different from the mainstream in this country, and in fact, not different from the liberal communities that I was studying up in Chicago. I think that in some ways our thinking about race in this country is so pervasive that while there are important political differences, there really isn't a lot of difference in our racial discourse.
So had you looked into any other political party before you looked into the Tea Party?
Not necessarily. My expertise and my interest isn't really in politics per se. In fact, one of the things that was challenging about it is that I don't actually have a lot of stomach for politics. So it's not. It wasn't the fact of it being a political movement or even necessarily a partisan interest, but more about the way that I study how people talk and think about race made this movement particularly interesting to me.
So let me ask you, I want to go back to something you said earlier about signs that you saw at gatherings of Tea Party members.
Yeah.
What were you seeing?
Well, I was seeing what was showing up on the news, which were, for example, posters that had pictures of Obama as an African witch doctor, for example, or, someone holding up a sign that says, "Don't blame me, I voted for the white guy." Yet, I think one thing that I should make very clear is that the people that I talked to in the movement were very, very strongly opposed to messages like that. They would tell me stories about approaching the very few people at the protests who had signs like that or were saying things that were were more sharply racist, and they were really intentional about not giving them a platform. I think our entertainment media system, and this happens on the left and the right, of course is going to go to those as a way to magnify those things. But the thinking and the talking about race that I saw among movement members was in some ways very ordinary and not all that different than the rest of the country.
You hear at times the Republican Party portrayed as the party with no divergence. It's, you know, it's just a bunch of old white guys. Now, you said, what do you say to that?
Well, I do think that it, as far as the party itself, I mean, I think there's an important distinction here. The Tea Party is, in many ways, very clear about not being part of the Republican Party. Many of them do vote Republican because they're conservatives, and that's often the platform. But I don't want to. I want to be careful about not conflating those two. And I think that in terms of the diversity inside of the movement, you know, I only looked at organizers here in Illinois, and my method was to really focus on those organizers because they're the ones sort of connecting the dots within the state and working in some ways with national groups. And so it wasn't just Tea Party sympathizers, but more those who were really doing the activism. All of the folks that I met were white, and I think that in such a segregated society, some misunderstanding about where we are with respect to racial equality shows up that way. I mean, when we are in such a segregated society, we often don't have any way other than what we hear in the media for understanding each other or attempting to understand each other. And so there is some conflict there. And it was a majority white movement, and all the folks that I interviewed were white.
You said another facet of the Tea Party movement is the belief that those involved feel that they're not represented by their elected officials. I think that covers every political party.
I agree. You know, and it's so funny because I was very clear with the folks that I was interviewing and hanging out with at campaign trainings and, you know, Tea Party conventions and things like that. I didn't hide. So I'm not conservative, and I didn't hide my politics from people when they asked. And what that made on one level was some really rich conversations. But what it also meant is that, you know, there were times when pieces of what they're talking about, even though I don't vote Tea Party, I don't vote Republican, they're talking about, you know, not feeling like they're represented by their elected officials. They're talking about thinking that there's too much money in politics and that that has more sway than, you know, quote unquote, we the people. And they really seem to be craving the democracy that we've tried so hard to build in this country. And on those points, I'm totally with them.
How many Tea Party organizations did you, because we have a local here in McLean County, Bloomington
right.
Normal. How many did you visit that one, by the way? Did you talk to anybody from
Well, I'm in order to uphold the confidentiality of my participants, I'm not allowed to say exactly who I talked to, but I will say that I got pretty good coverage throughout the state. Another thing that surprised me was that folks, and this was early, you know, I was collecting my data in 2010, 2011, but folks were really eager to have someone listen fairly and carefully to what they were doing. And so folks, by and large, were really eager to speak to me, and I'm just so appreciative that they were, because I think and I hope that I've been able to paint a much more complex picture of the Tea Party in this book. I am critical of the racial discourse, meaning the way that they talk about race and the way that we think about race in this country. I mean, I study racism for a living, so I've got a lot of insight into that. So there is criticism, but there was stuff like that I very much agreed with.
Yeah, are there, you said you're not political, because I'd be interested to see what you found if you did the same thing with the Democratic Party, if you did the same thing with the Republican Party, the Green Party, I mean.
Oh, I totally agree. And in fact, that's what became so interesting to me, because, again, my first book was looking at racially diverse communities in Chicago that were really proud of their racial diversity. They really felt that as an important part of their brand and their community. And these communities were very proudly and loudly liberal and even progressive. I mean, very pro-Obama even before he was elected president, and really pride themselves on their liberal politics. And that's exactly the thing. The word that we have for this in my scholarly community, we call it colorblind racism, which is a paradox, right? But what that speaks to is the very paradox that I think we have in this country. Colorblindness is a totally noble ideal. Yes, of course, the color of someone's skin or their racial characteristics shouldn't matter to us. And we, in the civil rights movement, really worked to make the laws fair so that there could be this equal opportunity. And yet today we have rising rates of racial inequality and a lot of what we call coded racism. And so that was present in the Tea Party, absolutely, that way of thinking and talking. But it was also present in these progressive, we love diversity communities up in Chicago. And I think that that's really revealing about where we are as a nation.
That was Illinois Wesleyan Professor Megan Burke with our Scott Laughlin. Tri-Valley High School student Austin Spencer has been through a rough few years. The 18-year-old just returned to school after spending nearly a year undergoing chemotherapy and a bone marrow transplant for a rare immune deficiency disease called HLH, one that has also afflicted his brother. Austin, along with his basketball coach, John Nelson, talked to WJBC this week.
What has the transition been like for you to get back into the classroom?
It's actually been pretty easy considering everyone knows the situation and is willing to help. And everyone has been very kind and generous to my family and definitely made the transition very easy.
Well, and a little bit more about your story, having a rare condition, one of, I believe, only 50 in the country, having this XLP2, which your younger brother also is dealing with. He's in Cincinnati right now, I understand?
Yeah, he's in Cincinnati Children's Hospital right now, and he has been for the past few months. Been staying in there because of complications with the bone marrow transplant. So,
well, you went through that previously, a pretty remarkable process for you by the looks of it.
Yeah, I actually did a lot better than was expected and was able to completely pretty much overcome it and almost back to completely healthy now.
Back to before you got the transplant, what was going through your mind as you went through this process, wondering what was going to happen?
Well, it was very scary knowing the statistics of bone marrow transplant and the survival rates and everything that goes along with it, with complications like my brother's having and that other people have had. So it was definitely a very scary time when we were hearing about all the statistics and everything that goes through with bone marrow transplants.
How old were you when you were first diagnosed?
I was 16. A couple months into my 16th.
It's a lot to have to think about at that age.
Yeah, it was definitely a big thing to be sprung on me my summer of when I was 16, so going into my junior year.
And so you were in Cincinnati for quite a time, too.
Yeah, I came to Cincinnati on New Year's Day, 2014, and stayed there till almost around Thanksgiving time, so about 11 months.
And, of course, you had to keep up with your classwork at the time, too, and you're a basketball player. And what was going through your mind then about your desire to get back out on the basketball court?
Yeah, it definitely was just my goal was always to be back for the beginning of the season and just doing whatever I can to make sure that I could make that goal a reality. And I was lucky enough to be able to have my dad there to practice with me and keep me motivated to come back and play basketball.
And from what I understand, part of your process before you went in was to try to be as healthy as possible. And so you were actually out working out, in a sense, in the gym trying to get healthy before this.
Yeah, before I even went, I was just trying to, because when I originally was diagnosed, I had to take a steroid, and it completely wiped all my strength out and everything. So even before I went for transplant, I was weaker than normal and had to battle that, too.
Well, and as you went through this process, you had someone to help you in this, not just your coach, but one of your teachers in John Nelson. And John, what has this been like for you to have someone, one of your students, one of your student athletes, go through this and to be with them through this process?
You know, it's been definitely hard being a father of two girls. You know, I tell people all the time, and people that are in coaching and teaching understand that, that students and their players are a lot like their own children. So not necessarily to the extent that his parents went through, but, you know, obviously a very difficult situation when something like that occurs.
How do you see your role in that then, as you said, as a coach, as a teacher, to be at his side and to be an aid in any way you can?
You know, the biggest thing was, you know, obviously with his parents and that if there was anything I could do to help him along the way. And I know, you know, a lot of times high school kids aren't comfortable talking with their parents about certain things, and sometimes they're more comfortable with a teacher or coach. So, you know, I basically just tried to be there for him as much as I could in any way possible.
How has Austin done?
It's been miraculous. I mean, way ahead of expectations of doctors, of us. You know, when you head into that, you know, you're telling him to be positive and do that stuff in the back of your mind. You're thinking, you know, worst case scenarios or things like that. And it's just been absolutely unbelievable, his comeback and, you know, everything that he's been through.
At what point, Austin, did you start to think about and perhaps talk about wanting to get back and play basketball?
Really, ever since I was diagnosed, I was on the comeback trying to be on the team and just do my best to get to back where I was sophomore year on the varsity basketball team.
And what did the coach think about that at that point?
You know, obviously we were big on him setting goals and having a vision because we knew that would be something he could work toward. And, you know, our job was to support him through that process, but at the same time, you know, telling ourselves, man, is this really possible? But, you know, I have to give him a lot of credit. I mean, I've never seen a kid work, you know, and get through something like he did. I mean, his perseverance is amazing.
We understand that you're planning to go to Illinois State in the fall?
Yeah, I plan to go to Illinois State this coming fall and majoring in, like, biology.
The IHSA has announced that you have been nominated for the NFHS Spirit of Sport Award. Pretty remarkable achievement. So more people will learn about your story.
Yeah, I hope some people can hear about my story and get motivation from it and realize that there's more to life than just, like, sports, and you need to never take anything for granted.
Even though it seems like those sports helped drive you to make a comeback, correct?
Yeah, definitely. I always had a goal to come back and play basketball, but I never lost sight of my grades and schoolwork, and I was always able to get that done along the way, too.
Coach Nelson, what are you going to tell your students down the road in 5, 10, 15, 20 years about this experience and about this young man?
You know, I mean, it's an absolutely amazing story. You know, we talk to our student athletes all the time about perseverance and doing those things, and I will never have probably an example along these lines. And, you know, obviously it's something that we'll continue to have him back throughout the years as he gets more comfortable talking about the situation and looking back on it. But it will be an amazing story that, you know, will forever last around the school and the program as far as what he's been able to do.
That was Tri-Valley senior Austin Spencer and his coach, John Nelson. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. After publicly criticizing a conservative blogger earlier this week, Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner issued an apology directly to Diane Benjamin. Renner had apologized for strong words he posted on Benjamin's blog earlier in the week, but had not issued his regrets to Benjamin herself until Friday.
And I did tell her that I was sorry for the remark that I'd made on her blog, and I certainly regretted my actions.
Renner had described Benjamin as sick, slimy, and ignorant in the post. He says after thinking it over, apologizing was the right thing to do. Three of the four candidates in Bloomington's 4th Ward met on Illinois Wesleyan's campus this week for a debate. One topic discussed was the need for a downtown hotel. Jeremy Kelly says he'd love to see a downtown hotel if the market supports it.
However, we cannot, as a public community, jump in and fund a downtown hotel because we are setting it up for failure if we do that.
Chip Frank says he would vote against it.
I think it would be a great asset to the community. However, I don't think the city should pay for it.
Amelia Burgess says a hotel could bring millions of dollars to the city.
I can't say that it's going to happen. I haven't seen any plans yet, and I don't know if I was on council if I'd vote in favor of what those plans were, but we can't rule it out.
Candidates Ron Schultz and Dan Metz were unable to attend. Protesters outside the McLean County Law and Justice Center this week claimed the driver in a fatal pedestrian crash wasn't charged because one of the victims was an immigrant. McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers says the decision not to charge anyone for the deaths of Pedro and Alejandro Guerrero in October of 2013 was not based on race.
But for me to charge someone just because they were minorities, that would be racist. And it seems to me that some folks have started to become the very thing that they're trying to advocate against, and that's unfortunate.
Chambers says Pedro and Alejandro were walking on an unlit county road shortly after sunset in black clothing before they were hit. He also says the driver was cooperative during the investigation and didn't commit a chargeable offense. Joshua Dunn has pleaded not guilty to charges stemming from an alleged fatal hit-and-run crash last month. The 21-year-old Dunn entered the plea in court on Friday to charges of leaving the scene of an accident involving a death and felony driving under the influence of marijuana. Dunn is accused of hitting and killing 20-year-old Benjamin Allison with his car while Allison was walking at a crosswalk at the intersection of College and Fell Avenues in Normal early in the morning on January 24th. And McLean County Health Department officials are trying to reassure parents that their children are protected against diseases like the measles, which has had 10 cases reported in the Chicago area. Vaccination rates for McLean County school children top 98% for measles, polio, rubella, mumps, and DTP, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. County Health Director Walt Howell says these figures show McLean County schools are providing an atmosphere of protection. The state recommends vaccination rates of at least 90% to ward off an epidemic. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. Monday is President's Day. Government offices will be closed, as well as most schools, banks, and post offices. On Tuesday, a man accused in a fatal hit-and-run crash in Normal will be in court seeking to have his bond reduced. Joshua Dunn is accused of the death of pedestrian Benjamin Allison. And Thursday is Founders Day at Illinois State University. ISU plans to honor former Senator John Maitland and his wife Joanne. The Maitlands will be presented. And Thursday is Founders Day at Illinois State University. And ISU plans to honor former Senator John Maitland and his wife Joanne. The Maitlands will be presented with honorary doctoral degrees. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.